Greetings, dear listeners. Before we get started, a reminder to head on over to wisdomofcrowds.live and consider becoming a paying subscriber if you're not one yet. You'll get access to, among other things, the full conversation, as well as other subscriber-only benefits. And don't forget to give us a like and review on your favorite podcast app. With all that out of the way, on to the show. Recording. Now we're recording. Now you can tell jokes.
Okay, now we can tell jokes.
Why don't you also, you know, I mean, this is a cursed podcast, I'll just say.
Yeah.
This is maybe the fourth time we've tried to record this now.
This is the demons in the silicone.
Yeah.
This is what they warned you about.
I mean, so it's pretty late on a Thursday night right now. We've tried three times to record
by pretty
this
late we mean 11 p.m.
p.m. and you'll
after,
be, listen- and you'll be
and
listening
I've had no, I only have one glass of wine,
so. Okay, I've had no glasses of wine,
yeah,
because I'm though
you're temperate though, virtuous in every direction,
right.
as all Wisdom Crowds listeners know,
though, unlike our friend Shadi, who is actually not just doesn't drink but like is fasting right now, I am not fasting, but like I am very temperate.
It's just your normal state of being.
A normal state of being.
Quality of virtue.
Anyway,
infused through every part
of
your life.
All I wanted to say right now, Sam, is, you know, we won't belabor the point for our dear listeners, but the fact is that it is late and they're going to get this actually pretty hot off the presses, I think,
because
by the
true.
Time we finish this, it's going to be time to upload it. But I would just, I would advise you, since we're now not recording through technology, this is the minimum amount of technology recording. I would suggest to you, you look very uncomfortable. It's late. Like, figure out that mic so you can, like, I don't know, not
do a little bit of lounging.
Yeah, you should lounge when you do this because you're not going to make it. It's late. You have like a wine in you. There's no way you're going to make it through a conversation.
Light mid podcast napping.
Yeah,
is what
yeah,
you're proposing.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I think this should be
your eyes are closed.
This should be like, you know, have you heard of this stuff? This crazy stuff the kids are up to these days. ASMR. Have you heard of this stuff?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah, this is what this podcast should be. It should just be like, because it's late on a Thursday, we should just get like wrapping paper and other like weird things and just like
just crinkle them into the microphone.
Yeah. It's a new direction. It's like, why do you believe what you believe? Just shut up and listen to the freaking paper crinkling in such delightful ways. Oh, man.
It could be a new crossover market for us.
You know,
yeah.
It's probably a good market.
Yeah.
I mean, that's modernity that I don't fully understand yet. though I will say, okay, maybe this is a way in. I remember like when I was a lot younger, I remember it's like staying home from school if I, you know, like got the flu or something, I got the fever. And I don't know if you've had this experience ever, when you get like a really good fever and it's a really honking fever, you know what I mean? That you're like laid out.
Yeah, what are the appropriate adjectives for large scale fever?
Honking.
Honking.
A honking fever. And so I don't know if you ever had that, but you know, where it just like you, it really makes you kind of nod out. Like it does sort of get you in a trance-like state. Have you ever experienced that?
What I've experienced is like kind of wild dysphoria. And I have memories of
dysphoria.
That. Yeah, like as a child where like you lose the sense of proportion, space and
yeah.
Especially space, but time also can sort of just start sort of like bending in ways that you that are definitely like not normal.
So I mean, I remember two things. I remember, you know, watching, you know, you're at home from school, you've got a fever, you're in front of a TV. So I remember, you know, like falling asleep and drifting in and out of stuff. And, you know, that's pretty common, I think. I do remember at some point with like two things sort of interlocking. Once, like with a fever, falling asleep in that delirious sort of mode, And this is where it sort of reminds me of this ASMR thing, because I remember the sort of image of falling asleep, or not the image that was rattling around my head as I was sort of falling asleep in this delirium, was a what do you call it? Like a, you know, like on a gramophone, a cartridge, which is where the needle is.
Yeah.
And so, like, sort of my field of vision is like focusing on the needle as it's like coming down into the grooves of the record.
Yeah.
And just like slowly, and it's like asymptotically approaching. And it's this kind of silence, but it's a very full and buoyant silence. Like, And I remember as the needle is like approaching, then like asymptotically, it's just like out, like I pass out. So that's one thing. And I remember another sort of delirious moment like this was, I think, watching 2001. And I feel like I'd seen it, you know, as a kid before, not in a fever. And I remember watching it with a fever once and realizing, especially those crazy scenes towards the end, when you know, basically Hal has already killed the other guy and Dave has actually killed Hal at that point, and Dave is alone. And, you know, he's flying off into space, I forget, into like the rings of Saturn or whatever the hell. And before he gets into the weird human zoo where the aliens are looking at him, like that whole scene where he's going into the colors and they're like coming at him and the soundtrack is like again. And again, like, you know, there's these crazy shots of just, you know, lights coming at him and just snapshots of Dave just like staring at this. And I remember watching that with a fever and I was like, that is like, that's delirium. That is like delirium that Kubrick has captured. And that, I totally linked it to that like descending needle thing.
What happens with fever.
With a fever. And I mean, I watched that with fever though. And that was the connection
so,
I made.
No, but it's, I mean, it, what's interesting about all of this is that there's a, the, I think, you know, I think there's a disorientation that I also identify with, like with how philosophy kind of got in for me, which is like those, I remember some of those like early undergrad classes where it's some of the classic stuff like Brain and Vat, but you know, like a lot of other of these kind of like ways of questioning these prior assumptions that you have about the world. And you gradually realize like most people go around thinking like a lot of things are obvious and easy, that you gradually realize, wow, like, you know, yeah, what if the whole world is just a simulation? Or what if like causality doesn't work at all? Or what, like, why do I think time has any kind of flow to it? And I do think of those like kind of moments of delirium in a semi-similar kind of fashion.
Do you think that's you think that kind of like weird delirium moment is what has inspired a lot of philosophy? Because I'll say one thing, like I don't like, more often than not, I feel like it hasn't. I mean, it certainly, it applies to certain writers, but not the majority of them.
I'd say the feeling of slippage between like something like, I think we all, I mean, it's very common that humans have this experience of like having a world. And I think that's often very naive. It's like you are awake, you're rushing around, you're going out for drinks with friends, you're whatever. And like all of that is just a kind of a flow that is experience. And you assume that you are what you are and the world is what it is and sort of running through it. But I think a lot of philosophy actually comes from that feeling of dysphoria or questioning. I mean, Descartes has that very famous meditation about how perception can lead you wrong. So things like sticks bending, that these are ways of interacting where you think initially like you can always just trust the way that your vision works, and then suddenly you realize, oh no, like it's actually not the case. So I mean, I do think to put all of this like positively though, like I think that the point is that maybe I'm not sure you can study philosophy until you get to the point that you realize, oh, being in the world is not obvious. Like whatever it is, however we experience life, however we go about it, it's not just simple and straightforward. There are these like bending breaking points in all kinds of respects.
I guess I think you're right about like that you need to at least sort of get there, however you get there, in order to do it seriously. I'll grant you that. I actually haven't read that much Descartes, so I don't know how experiential he gets. Obviously, he does in his writing when he's breaking down, what are those, meditations? Is that what he calls them?
Yeah.
I mean, when he's breaking it down, surely. But there's something methodical about how he does it. And like, actually, I was just as you were talking, I went and dug up this passage. Like it's the beginning of The Genealogy of Morals by Nietzsche in the preface. Let me see if I can. Yeah, this is that. And this also just reminds me of a lot of this stuff. And I think this is why I said like not all writers, but someone like Nietzsche for sure, right?
Yeah, for sure.
It says, rather, as one divinely preoccupied and immersed in himself, into whose ear the bell has just boomed with all its strength, the 12 beats of noon, suddenly starts up and asks himself, what really was that which just struck? So we sometimes rub our ears afterward and ask, utterly surprised and disconcerted, what really was that which we have just experienced? And moreover, who are we really? And afterwards, as foresaid, count the 12 trembling bell strokes of our experience, our life, our being, and alas, miscount them.
So good.
But it's you know, I remember reading that in college, and you know, it's one of those things that also, I don't know if this is sort of universal, but like, again, it's, doesn't happen all the time, but sometimes, you know, you wake up, either if it's been some sort of weird dream, or you wake up and you're in that exact space. And it's happened to me that it's like you're in the shower or something, and all of a sudden you just sort of like lose yourself. I don't sing in the shower. Presumably maybe this is why some people sing in the shower, because they just lose themselves. And you lose yourself to such an extent that you're like, whoa, hold on a second, where am I? What's going on? How did I get here? But it's not like memory loss or anything like that. It's not that like I've forgotten, but it's this kind of just like temporary collapse of everything that you find yourself like in this thing, right? And that's what I always thought about when like reading that passage of Nietzsche, like, you know, as an undergraduate, I was like, oh, that's what he's sort of getting at. But you know what I mean? Like those are, it's that kind of, I mean, it seems like it's a kind of modern way to write about stuff.
I mean,
right?
So I think what I will grant to the argument you're making is, actually, I think I've brought this up on the podcast before. Liam Bright, this philosopher at LSE, he does a lot of fun and kind of cheeky work. But the distinction that he makes between philosophers who are basically pleasant bureaucrats versus philosophers who are sexy murder poets. Mm-hmm. And I do think that he's actually, it's a quite fun way to articulate it, but I think that he's actually getting at something real, which is, I would say that the experience of philosophy is one that's intrinsically disorienting. Like, mm-hmm. I don't, like I said a second ago, like I don't think you can do it until you've been disoriented that way. And one text that I think about a lot is actually one of the very first texts we have from philosophy, which is, I gave a paper about this in Rome last year, so Plato has a dialogue called Parmenides, but it's named after a philosopher called Parmenides from the generation before Socrates. And it's this hymn to the kind of the unity of the cosmos. And it's usually taken to argue two theses, which to I think almost everyone who encounters them the first time, it seems crazy. One, that there's no change at all and nothing has ever been different. And two, that there's only one thing. It's perfectly fully unified. We only have fragments of this, so we don't really know how the whole argument works, but it does feel deeply, deeply disorienting. But on the other hand, it was compellingly enough stated that it genuinely ended up shaping generations of philosophers who are trying to respond to it. I think it's actually very plausible to think that Socrates and Plato and Aristotle are all themselves kind of captivated by this, disconcerted, not sure what to do with it, and then responding to it in various ways. So what I'd say is that philosophy does seem really disorienting that way. It throws you into this sense that things that felt secure and foundational are actually very insecure and you don't know where to stand. And it does have an ambiguity to it. What I was going to say a second ago is, to grant your point, I do think that there are philosophers, there are people, those people involve, like, are very desperate to get rid of that feeling of dysphoria, want to find a new foundation, want to kind of establish some solid footing. I think Descartes is totally in that category. And then there are others who kind of swerve into it and think, no, there's something actually hugely important about this sense of dysphoria. And I would definitely put myself in the latter category. Like, I think there's a way in which whatever that experience is, however you think of existential ambiguity, it's actually really, really significant for how we go about living.
Mm. So here's a question for you, which is sort of tied to, I mean, stuff that, like, I've written at Wisdom Crowds last year or so, and that still sort of, I don't know, occupies my thinking. Let me ask it in a very narrow way, getting back to the Greeks and this sort of question. As you're describing Parmenides and then the reaction to this, you know, we don't know the full argument, but the fragment of argument about the whole and parts. To what extent can we make sense of that in the modern way because of what the self is and how the self is conceived? Because, I mean, I've said this to you maybe even on the podcast, but certainly offline several times, that I'm always struck when reading the ancients that I feel like they are oriented to experience in a very different way, because the notion of the self is a modern construction and part of our own modern psychology and part of our modernity and how we're brought up in it and how we develop psychologically within this society that actually feels fundamentally different from how it was back then. That there's a gulf between us and them to a certain extent, that just we can understand what they're on about, but it's almost understanding via some kind of analogy through a gulf rather than actually knowing what they're on about, because they're actually cut off from us to a certain extent. So, I mean, is there anything to that? And this is just sort of a means of then sort of nudging us to a conversation about, you know, the self, basically, because I think a lot of the questions that we've sort of run on the pod the last few months and on the site the last few months, and most specifically recently, the Oliver Tralee essay and then your essay about unhappiness and existence, is, to me, as I read both of them, is somehow tied to this problem of the self. But answer the first question a little bit about, you know, the Greeks and, you know, and the self as a product of modernity versus something that actually is human and we can understand it throughout history in the same sort of way and relate to it.
Yeah, I mean, this is great. I mean, the way we initially thought that we would do this podcast was because we've done a lot of stuff about happiness and unhappiness. Shadi is very, very occupied by this. We ran this essay by Tralee. I had a thing on this week on Monday. And then you wrote a really, I think, genuinely one of the best things we published over the past year, wonderful essay last fall sometime about the sense of wonder and your relationship to kind of growing older, the way that the world feels rich and thick and enchanted in certain times of life, and then it's sort of some of those things fade away. So how does the world actually work? And I think it's a preoccupation. I think one of the reasons that you and I thought it'd be fun to do a podcast specifically on this is because I think there are places that you and I share an orientation here, though maybe with really different premises, like underlying it, that's a little bit different than Shadi or maybe Christine too. And trying to probe at that a little bit and trying to understand how that's working seems valuable. So to the thing about the self, this is actually more or less what I wrote on for my PhD. And I worked a lot on the Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor, who has he has a number of really important books, but two very long and important books. One is called Sources of the Self, in which he tries to wrestle exactly with this question. How did the very specific notion of selfhood show up, and it's definitely not there throughout history. So what is it, and where did it come from, and how do you understand it? And then he has a second very long, also important book called Secular Age, in which he is trying to map out how is it that in, as he says, in 1500, almost everyone has some deep sense of cosmic transcendence or sort of cosmic religious sense. And in, he's writing it in 2007, it comes out in 2007, you have very, very strongly contested views about that kind of frame of how much transcendence holds. So one of the distinctions that he makes that I think is really, really, I still think is really genius. He says that in our, he thinks modernity is an age of buffered self. So by that, he means we work very, very hard to draw lines around individuality and around our kind of interaction with the world. And that, you know, there are ways that you can like develop hyperactive discipline. So the old ideas of like kind of occasionally fasting or occasionally kind of maintaining a structured routine life become more and more entrenched in such a way that like you individually are defining yourself, your own project in all kinds of respects. And he thinks that's super unique and idiosyncratic and doesn't show up in hardly any other culture except for this very particular genealogy that we're in.
When does he mark the emergence of this?
He thinks you start getting it in the, well, I mean, there are, you know, like little threads that go all the way back in antiquity. I mean, he thinks you can already see this in like Roman martial discipline, the ways that certain societies pull select groups of people, especially young men, away and then set them off as a kind of caste of soldier and then develop a whole different set of habits in that way. He thinks there are ways that Western monasticism develops this kind of individuality. So in contrast, the old Roman pattern where people like sleep anywhere in the house, like all kind of jumbled together.
But interesting that soldiering would create a self rather than a selflessness and actually sort of a group cohesion, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. And monasticism too, right? Like you have a super regimented routine thing, but then he thinks, but that's like the, you know, like one of these times where you start getting individual rooms for sleeping, for example, like cells. So you start getting this kind of like, both regimen and individuality kind of developing in various ways. But he thinks like the real project of like buffering that he thinks like totally defines a modern self is especially pronounced from 16th century onward and just gets more and more intensified in all sorts of respects. So that like by now, you know, we all talk about like finding your true self and the authentic discovery of who you are and like that this is what your life should be about, like expressing your will and your, like all of that seems totally idiosyncratically modern.
Yeah.
Like that idea of authenticity.
But so does he go so far as to say that it's false? I mean, it's a fraught question to say what's false because it's experienced within, it is part of our experience. So it's impossible to say it's false. But you know, the parallel I always bring to this is, you know, the self, we have to take it for granted. It's so embedded in how we express ourselves, how we talk. It's embedded in our language. To the same exact way, it seems to me like free will just has to be assumed because we can't describe the world in a meaningful way, or we can't describe society. We can describe the world without free will, but we can't describe a society without the conceit of a free will. And I feel like in a similar sort of way, we can't describe experience without some recourse to self.
I don't know. I mean, you do have lots and lots of ancient descriptions of experience that don't have to do with the self.
And I guess there's poetry. Yeah, and there's exactly. Poetry and there's there is that, and then there's, right, this sort of, the experiences, you know.
I think the point is that the idea of self as cut off, that's very unique.
Yeah.
So, if you think about most ancient poetry, think about Virgil, think about Homer, these are like, you know, there are people, and they have agency, and they have experience, and they have like very powerful emotion in many cases. Like actually, I think a lot of ancient stuff has much more powerful display of emotion than you get in modern stuff. I mean, and sometimes like, you know, like think about like the siren the sequence of the sirens in Homer, like, you know, that kind of idea of like magnetism that's so strong that you literally cannot resist it, but it's your feeling that's drawing you in. I mean, that's wild. And like that sense of kind of agentlessness in relation to it is fascinating. And, you know, does kind of track certain kinds of experiences. But I think that the, you know, there are a lot of things that are very unique. I think Taylor especially thinks the experience of an external world that's empty and vacuous of meaning, and then an internal world that you have to go in and find your true sense of purpose and meaning, and that will be the thing that gives you a meaningful life. That whole
that dichotomy is,
yeah, the like parenting thing, you know, what do you want for your kids? Oh, I don't have any like specific plan. I just want them to be happy.
Right.
They need to like express what they really care about. Like all of that kind of language, that seems very, very recent.
Right. Well, that is very recent. But I mean, I'm still sort of struck on the bigger stuff that you're talking about, the second half of the two books that you were talking about, that in fact,
the secular age,
that this sense of wonder, maybe put it that way, that engagement with the outside world in a not necessarily very subjective way. I don't know if that's the way to put it, but like that's one way to sort of think about it, that's gone away, or at least is not as prevalent as it once was.
Yeah.
I mean, the balance has shifted in any case, strongly in favor of this selfhood, right?
Yeah. And, you know, so so to keep on the literature theme.
Yeah.
So if you think about a lot of these epic poems, they're not really fiction.
Right.
Like they're kind of they're taken to be descriptive of the world. So you know, the Odyssey is taken to be like real stuff that happens to the soldiers after they leave the battle at Troy, and it's taken to be total like a literal description of like how the and you know it, we know that in part because of the reception history, like the ways in which people then like identify this as like a kind of history. And I think you see that similarly with a lot of North African literature. I think you also see it with Dante. Like I think Dante is taking himself to in some kind of way be describing like an actual feature of the world as he's going through hell and purgatory and all these things. That's wildly different than like J.K. Rowling, right? Like that's taken to be fiction. Like she's playing with a kind of fabricated England and Scotland that is clearly just like making things up. And it's fun. It's very like entertaining. It can maybe teach you certain things about the world, but it's definitely not a sense that the world itself has that level of meaning to it. That's why we have like realist literature versus fantasy literature. Those are split genres.
Now you've uncorked all sorts of things, partly because I've never read J.K. Rowling.
Yeah, fair.
And it's been such a long time since I've read Homer and Virgil. I read Virgil in college and therefore like not that carefully in undergraduate. And I was a Latin nerd, so we translated parts of the Iliad and Odyssey and obviously read in English back then. And I've not gone back to it, except I picked up the Iliad recently being the last 3 years, and read about like maybe a third of it. So, you know, it's like you're dealing with I mean, I appreciate what you're saying more or less, though. I mean, you know, the question again of the ancients, what struck me about reading the Iliad, a year or so ago, 2 years ago, was sure, it's a historical account, and there's lots of emotions and passions that go into it. And in a way, the characters are reasonably developed and recognizable as people. They're not caricatures. They're drawn reasonably well. But at the same time, they're not relatable. That I find, you know, like the mark of that. I don't remember the Odyssey enough to remember if like Odysseus is more fully formed than Achilles was, for example, or than Agamemnon was. And I just don't remember. I mean,
they, in some ways, there are features which are, I actually think, more accessible or less elusive than some modern novels. Yeah. So, you know, if you compare like these postmodern novels where sort of like fragmentary consciousness jumping between like text chains and self-interrogation and whatever, like all this stuff, like it's actually kind of hard to trace the character. Whereas like I'm thinking of the Iphigenia and Aulis, which is a really wonderful play about largely centering around Agamemnon. The person's actually kind of explicable. Like there's, he has authority for, he is super ambitious, kind of venal. He ends up in this position where he has authority over the army, but the army is like fuming because they're the winds have all stopped and he's not able to kind of get the ships going to get to Troy. And so there is this like, you know, like boiling mass of soldiers who are like intent on violence and just like sitting and getting more and more frustrated. And he's worried that they're going to go and, you know, kill him, kill like everyone basically, just out of like that sort of boiling frustration. And and then he also loves his daughter and
he sacrifices her, if I remember right, to get the winds.
Right. So the whole, exactly. So the whole thing is that they have killed the holy animal at the temple. And so then the steward of the temple comes back and says, look, unless you make a sacrifice of your own daughter, you will not get the winds running again. And so then he has to make this like very deep, heart-wrenching choice. I feel like that kind of emotion is familiar in like some important ways. Like that, the question of split loyalties and how you want to deal with like things that, multiple things you care about a lot and don't know how to reconcile. That feels, you know, explicably human to me.
Right. Right. But it's like reading Bible stories too, right? They're sketched out and recognizable as things, but they're not modern. Again, is what it is. There's something fundamentally different about it.
Yeah.
And maybe that's what I'm getting at. Like, I mean, the reason I was struggling over J.K. Rowling when you brought it up recently, like I take your point about that Virgil wasn't strictly doing fantasy.
No, yeah, I'm not sure he thinks he's doing fiction at all.
Right, but at the same time, I mean, he's I don't know what would you call it. I mean, obviously, what is it called? That like, is it heroic poetry?
It's epic
poetry, right? It's epic poetry that he's doing. So it's a style. Yeah, I mean, is it real though? I guess that I'm stumbling over that. It's clearly not the fantasy genre of J.K. Rowling, but epic poetry also is not exactly history. It's edifying. It's supposed to be edifying. It feels like that.
I think it's more than edifying because, you know, so if you think about stories about Romulus and Remus or, you know, like the Aeneid, like these are stories about establishing credentials also.
Right.
And lineage, posterity, legitimacy.
Right.
Which is serious business. And it's serious only in as much as you take it to be true in some real sense. Now, what the word true, like what you need from that in that sense, I think is real.
I mean, just ask the question of the Aeneid, you know, it is already by the time of Livy, right? Like when he's writing about the beginnings of Rome, he's pretty much openly saying that these are nice theories stories. He doesn't go so far as if I remember to say that they're useful, but you know, he lays them out as these sorts of things, but understands them not as metaphorical, but no, like certainly not as historical, strong, yeah. You know, like, but not exactly as historical. Not in the sense, and I mean the differences again. Like I hope our listeners are following our free association here. But it's not like Thucydides, who goes to write a history, and it's a different approach than what Homer's up to, and quite frankly, what Virgil's up to as well. Right?
It's really interesting, though. I mean, the just to bring up yet one more classical text that will be obscure to our listeners. So Hesiod writes the Theogonies, which is taken to be, you know, like it's a pretty recognizable ancient genre, this kind of creation story. And it's wildly violent. Like it involves like the sky raping the earth and all kinds of things. Mm. But it is also plausibly interlinking with actual features of the land, the country, the readers know. So, you know, you have stories about Zeus and Olympus, and you also have a place called Olympus that people know and go to.
Sure.
And build temples. And so I do think that this is actually not very far away from what Taylor's writing about. So that feeling of kind of, and I mean, also what we've talked about from the beginning, like dreams, delirium, like that feeling of kind of interlinking, not quite differentiation that seems to be there in a lot of ancient literature. Like humans are sort of submerged into the world in a certain way. I do think that, you know, when right now I like how this conversation is going because we're talking about one specific part of antiquity. We're not talking about sort of ancient China. We're not like, right. And I think there are wildly different features. I think you have to be a real expert in like specific context to be able to make these judgments well. And Greece and Rome are the ones that I know best, though I've also studied, like North African, Middle Eastern stuff as well. And I think there is a kind of movement from that feeling of being submerged in and kind of in a place of working with the world that does gradually sort of, you know, we find ourselves on the other side of a big divide there, like of having individuality and a kind of emptiness outside. And I don't think that that's trivial. I think that that is a genuine, you know, like one of the languages that some writers that I've read use is like an evolution of consciousness. So like, as you think about it's not just that like species end up evolving between each other. It's also that like when you look at human history, there do seem to be features that are how we understand ourselves, how we understand being in the world, that sense of existential ambiguity, sense of what's real, like all of those things do seem changeable.
Right.
Well, and so actually like to kind of like, I think it'd be interesting to come back to some of this stuff about how the self started, but maybe it is worth talking about, I think you and I both feel ourselves uncomfortable with a lot of modern genres of like authenticity.
Right.
There's something about how people write about unhappiness, a lot of therapy culture,
right,
a lot of this sort of introspection stuff that doesn't quite feel on key to either of us, but maybe for different reasons.
Yeah, I think it is different reasons. I mean, I think I get where you're coming from, you know, not having, again, I think read an excerpt of Taylor in undergraduate, not having read Taylor as a fully formed adult. I can't really judge on the specifics of that. But I mean, I like, it's resonant as you describe it. But what bugs me about therapy culture is, I guess, sort of what you're saying, Taylor's pointing out, is like this development of the modern self. And it's...
And he's somewhat positive about it. Like he's like a 68 kind of person.
Yeah.
And so he has this like affection for a lot of that.
You know, what I was getting at?
Authenticity.
Like, but what language. I was getting at earlier, you know, about this question of, you know, the self and sort of, you know, and free will. That's why I keep coming back to this question of free will. And I think that is the, is what I've sort of landed on is what bugs me about therapy culture. It's maybe less the fact of the self, which feels more unavoidable to me, than doing the sort of, you know, the song and dance about free will, because I think like maybe I'll put it like this. I think it was very clear in the Oliver Tralee essay that we ran like a week and a half ago. You know, Oliver sets up this sort of, you know, this question of his own, I think, on happiness and sort of analyzing himself on this. And there's this question of choosing, and then that happiness, you know, comes from choosing the right thing and then identifying what makes one happy. And the act of doing that is somehow really important.
Yeah. And I mean, the problem he's trying to work out is like, what if I don't have, you know, in his case, like what if he doesn't have strong enough desires
right. That
would make a choice plausible, or like he gets stuck between many choices or whatever.
And the part that makes me like uncomfortable with all of that, and this is what makes me uncomfortable about like therapy culture, is again, this nexus of the self, the choosing self, and then, you know, this thing that we identify as desire as being intrinsic to the self, which needs to be identified again by the self and then sort of acted upon, and that happiness comes from either the satiation of this thing. And I think that like a lot of this stuff becomes easier to at least think about if one takes the question of free will kind of out of the equation. Because then desire also somehow comes out of the equation. And I think, well, maybe not desire. Desire doesn't come out of the equation, but I think one can then make it more, I don't know, epiphenomenal, I guess is what I'm getting at.
I mean, so this is actually like a really important philosophical debate. Is it seems like in like that sort of the mainstream of the philosophical tradition in like Middle East, Europe, North Africa, we don't really have an idea of the self. We don't really have the idea of free will as being defined by choice until quite late, actually, like surprisingly late, like 700, 800 CE is usually when it's dated to. And usually before that, like what you get is just this idea of impulse. So like when you talk about people being free, it's like desire, do stuff. Like that's sort of, it's like a much more direct visceral sequence.
Right.
Not this like, I'm stuck in the supermarket aisle and cannot decide what I'm going to eat. And like that, I do think that you're right to think therapy and a lot of the kind of introspection stuff that we have now is somehow tied to that sense of like frozen choice.
And
this is what people call voluntarism. Voluntarism as like the idea of just decision as a definitive thing for the self. That's weird and unique.
It's weird, unique, and I'll go even further, and this is why I'm so suspicious of therapy. I think encouraging it actually leads to unhappiness. That is the part that like why I'm more than anything.
There was a study going around this week about how a certain I don't remember the exact numbers, but like a very small selection of therapists actually seem to make their patients better. And then a large portion leave them very neutral. And then another, I think a slightly larger proportion than the first one, make them much worse.
Much worse.
Yeah, much worse.
But I've not gone to therapy. I don't, and I know it helps people. Again, these are the caveats I always say, because people can get really upset if you attack this, because it does help some people. So let's just caveat that out, you know, like if it's helping you, great. But I do think, there's something about this, because it encourages you to take a step back and think through these things more rather than less. I think it encourages on some level unhappiness. And I guess it's interesting that some of this sort of, you know, Eastern mysticism in the form of, it's not transcendental meditation. It's kind of the meditative stuff that now goes around. What is it called? Mindfulness, that sort of thing, right? In a way that's that kind of Eastern mysticism at this point actually is better, because in a weird way, it seems to encourage the abnegation of the self. Just like, take your set, take, get all that crap out of the way and focus yourself on what's actually happening. And what, you know, that to me, whatever, if you like get like really spiritual about it, you know, fine. Like it seems a little, I don't know, flaky to me, but as an exhortation, it seems a lot healthier to me than the introspection one.
So, I have lots and lots of views about all this. I have a friend who lives in the Bay Area, and he was talking about how many of the like, you know, people, families around are like nightstand Buddhists. So,
what's
like,
that mean?
You've got like incense and some meditation tips on your dresser, and then you sort of like indulge in this kind of like vague spiritualism stuff. Yeah. Actually, I kind of think a lot of that stuff is now being replaced by like sort of psychedelic enthusiasts, which is kind of interesting that like the Bay Area Buddhism trend can also like sort of wash out. Like, how serious was this? But he, you know, he's a very devout sort of high church Anglican and Episcopalian. And he said, like, for him, it's actually much easier for him to talk to like Buddhist monks who are like very, very serious about their practice than to any of those kind of other types of Bay Area people, because like there's an identification. Like, if this thing matters to you, it's definitely not, whatever it is, it's not a consumer product.
Right.
Like, it's not, oh yeah, like I'm rich, like I'm have a great career. I also feel really anxious, and so I need to go find something to kind of, and I mean, this is basically my view about how like the kind of cul-de-sac Americans have gotten ourselves into with this, where, you know, I think we may have talked about this previously. Like, I think there was a period where it looked like you could deal with big societal issues and very intimate issues together, like at the same time. So like, I think about like Hannah Arendt, like the way that she's able to write, or Simone Weil, like they're able to write about the meaning of the cosmos, the meaning of society, like how politics is working, and very, very direct human kind of questions, happiness, frustration, anxiety, whatever, all sort of like slipping between those registers. That's totally fractured now. Like, now you have like essentially like political books, which are like, here are 15 spreadsheets, like pie charts, which will tell you sort of how we should restructure the technical part of society. And that's like one genre of book, like Ezra Klein kind of books.
Yeah.
And then another genre is self-help. And like, self-help is like where you go and like you happen to be anxious after you already are successful, have a successful lawyer career. And then here are some tips to make it so that you don't feel so. And I think that I'm like sort of categorically against that split. I think it's really troubling how we've gotten into that pattern.
I'll just say I'm still not a fan of like the mid-century intellectual thing, because it seems faddish to me and like sort of not convincing. Just what you described, like Arendt doing, sort of. I mean, I think you, even in describing it, it describes why I'm not a fan of hers ultimately. Like it feels flaky. It feels like flaky, and the flakiness is developed into what you're now scorning in the modern thing. But let me just say one thing about what you also said at the end about the modernity. It's the self-help element that then serves up these meditation practices and mindfulness as just something on the menu, sure, nightstand sort of thing that you do. However, there's something about the practice. Think of the practice as self-abnegation. And I don't know, my instinct is that like almost everyone in society today would do well to self-abnegate as a practice, even if they do it as a, you know, a self-help tick that they will abandon for legal mushrooms and whatever the hell else. It would be good if just everyone got into the habit of destroying their confidence in their inner life. Do you know what I mean? It really is what I'm getting at, is that I think that unhappiness is an excess of inner life and being paralyzed by inner life. Now, I'm not saying, like, I think you don't want abnegation to the point of, again, delirium, where like there isn't anything like that. That's actually the road that these hippies are going to be taking mushrooms to, like, destroy their brains. That's not it. It's what really came out to me, like, jumped out at me in Oliver's essay, was that unhappiness of the self trying to choose and thinking about the act of choosing and the inability to do it and the loops in there. And it seems to me that anything that encourages people to literally lose faith in their self, that inner bullshit, that inner metaphysics, that thing of, like, the self observing the self and all the rest of that.
I mean, so that's where I want to object, actually. I don't think a lot of that stuff, I think a lot of that stuff is playing and it's not actually metaphysics. So, like, that's, and this is kind of actually, like, the subtext of the essay I was writing, like, where I do think that this is serious business and you really can't resolve it until you're doing, like, actual metaphysics, like, that you actually start to understand whether or not the world has weight, like, whether it has lightness or thinness to it.
I will encourage all of our listeners to go read your essay as well. But again, I mean, that was a question I had on the essay. That I do think we have to have this conversation for it to make sense. But where's the self in your essay? Where's the modern self in your essay? It's not there.
Yeah,
I noted that. I noted that as I was reading it. And I was happier to not see it there. And that's why, you know, on a level of, I think, call it healthy / helpful approaches, I grade you much higher than Oliver, who seems really stuck and really ill-served by everything that he seems to be trying to help himself. So, you know, what I'm saying, all that inner bullshit, that's the modern self is what I mean by that. I think one can still do metaphysics, and I'm not saying we can get rid of this concept of self. Like I said earlier, it's like kind of like we can't really get rid of the concept of free will. It's around. But I think, like, you know, lowering, maybe just deprioritizing it, like, how to, you know, desacralizing it. Maybe that's the word. Like, it's the self has become sacralized to a certain extent, and it needs to be debased. And we worship ourselves, our inner lives. And it, you know what I'm saying?
I think you and I have a fundamental agreement there, but the question is why and where do our premises work? So, you know, one of the distinctions between us is, like, I'm fairly religious, also High Church Episcopalian.
Yeah.
What are you?
I don't know.
Yeah, okay, cool. That's
nothing. And, yeah. I mean, truly nothing is the answer, I think.
And I do, so when I think about where my objections are to a lot of the introspection therapy stuff, it's that you look inside and what do you expect to find? Just more of yourself. And that is where, you know, so right. So in the essay that I wrote this week, the setup for it is just something that just happened to me, which was I was up in New York last week and came very close to an incident where a toddler who is running around the sidewalk almost stepped in front of a car in the street. And I sort of was not paying attention to, I had walked by and noticed the kid running around. And then this woman who was helping take care of him, just watching and trying to keep track of him. Then I was looking at my phone, trying to find the address for the next meeting I needed to go to. And then before I knew it, I'd already reacted and kind of seen him about to step into the street and put out my hand and held him back. And the point I make in the essay is that feels, whatever the experience of that was, it was maybe orienting to, you know, like, in contrast to what we were talking about at the beginning, like, disorientation for the world is orienting experience, because you instantly realize the stakes. Like, this child is important and should not end up in the street. Like, that kind of intensity of realization about an external part of the world. It's not just an inner experience. And I think that's what contrasted with Trollope's essay or with the other one that I was looking at this week in the New Yorker by Lauren Euler about anxiety, that in both of those cases, it's something real. Like, in, you know, wanting, desire, the experience of like apathy, the experience of like wild overstimulation of concerns that spread you out and rip you between yourself. These are real experiences. And there is a lot of ancient literature that works on those too. So Aristotle has these incredible passages in the Nicomachean Ethics about the experience of like being dragged and ripped and torn between different types of things. Like that is a real, I think, human, I think like our sensitivity lends us to that. But the idea of then going and constantly tinkering with it as if the you and your inner life is the center of the world, that I think you and I both fundamentally object to that.
Right. I mean, it's again, it's how you described desire without the self in a way, right?
Right.
It's there's desire and then, you know, and acting on that desire. But like it's what modernity's done is exploded the choice element at the core of it, right?
Yeah.
And that has now become the world. Is that choosing self of like, do I or do I not act on my desire? And then it's gotten so big that like you can't even identify desires anymore. It's like it's this whole where it's the self asking itself, what do I desire? And do I really desire it? And all these meta idiot questions that don't matter. Whereas yeah. It's fine to be, again, I don't know the passage you're talking about in Aristotle, but I imagine it's about passions, right?
Yeah.
And being pulled by those.
Yeah.
But it's not modern because it's not the question of Aristotle, the thinking, choosing self, you know, do I do this or do I do that? That's the modern invention and it's BS.
You know, I think
it's BS though.
Right. So, you know, one iteration, like if you think of current institutions that are kind of like working on this kind of stuff, one that feels a little bit more like antiquity to me is AA.
Mm.
Because
that's religious. AA is based on these things, right?
It's not very far away from religion.
That's it for part one, dear listeners. There's a lot more where that came from. If you're not yet a paying subscriber, please head on over to wisdomofcrowds.live and become one. Help support our work. Hope to see you in the bonus.